From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudet. You're listening to Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. We will get you up to date on the news that made headlines this last week. And our panel today includes Dawn Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, Carly Flandreau, reporter with Idaho Ed News, Will Walkie, reporter for the Mountain West News Bureau, as well as Wyoming Public Media, Ruth Brown with Idaho Reports, and Murphy Woodhouse, Mountain West News Bureau Boise reporter. Happy Friday, everybody.
Hey, Gemma.
Happy Friday.
Thanks, Gemma.
So, Ruth, I want to begin today's discussion with the news about the stay of execution for convicted murderer Thomas Creech. So can we just start by you giving us some quick background on the case for folks who may not be familiar?
Sure. Thanks, Gemma. Thomas Creech is Idaho's longest serving death row inmate. In 1981, he was convicted of killing a man named David Jensen. And last week, the state did issue a death warrant for him and set his execution for November 8th. However, his defense promptly requested a petition for a commutation hearing, which the Idaho Commission of Pardons and Parole did grant on Wednesday. And then yesterday, an Ada County judge then put a stay on the execution to allow time for that commutation hearing. I want to be clear, it's only a hearing. So the process still needs to move forward, but that's kind of where we're at.
Okay. So what's interesting about this as well, Ruth, maybe talk about also the fact that the judge who originally convicted Creech is now saying that he should not be executed?
Correct. Judge Robert Newhouse has publicly said that in, so backing up a little bit, when Thomas Creech was when Thomas Creech was sentenced in 1983, Judge Robert Newhouse was the sentencing judge, and he sentenced him to death multiple times because Mr. Creech had some appeals along the way and needed to be resentenced, and Newhouse repeatedly stuck with the death penalty. However, in his petition for a clemency hearing, Newhouse said basically that there would be no purpose in executing him now because Mr. Creech has been on death row for 40 years with the threat of execution hanging over his head. He had strong language in the opinion. He said that it would, quote, just be an act of vengeance, according to the petition. So that's where Judge Newhouse stands today. I don't know if the Commission of Pardons and Parole, and especially if the governor, will agree.
Mm-hmm. So, Ruth, where are we in the case right now? Because, as you said in the beginning, he was supposed to be executed November 8th. Judge Scott in Ada County earlier this week put a pause on that. So is it kind of so I guess what happens next in this process?
Sure, of course. So what happens is the Commission of Pardons and Parole will set a hearing date. At that hearing, and they haven't set one yet, I need to check this afternoon, but what happens is the defense will present their evidence regarding the fact that they believe Mr. Creech is a changed man. The state will present their evidence, I suspect, doubling down on Mr. Creech's offense. It was a violent crime that he committed. And then David Jensen's family is also allowed to speak at that hearing. The Commission of Pardons and Parole is made up of 7 members, and so they will vote, and the majority needs to support making a commutation recommendation, which, of course, I don't know whether they will get a majority to support commuting his sentence to life in prison. Also, for clarity for listeners, I think sometimes people think commutation means he gets out of prison. He does not. The at most, should they make a recommendation and the governor agrees, he would likely get life in prison without the possibility of parole. Mm-hmm. So he's not going anywhere. Additionally, just because the Commission of Pardons and Parole makes a recommendation, the governor does not need to follow that recommendation. We saw that in 2021. The commission did make a recommendation to commute the sentence of a man named Gerald Pizzuto, who's also on Idaho's death row, and the governor promptly denied it. Governor Little felt that the brutality of Mr. Pizzuto's crimes was so severe that the death penalty was just. And so to your initial question, we're waiting on the commutation hearing. They'll make a recommendation. Depending on what that recommendation is, we'll wait on the governor's decision.
Okay. And Ruth, wrapping this up, I know that you've covered executions in the past here in Idaho. Is this fairly common, what we're seeing right now in these legal steps and processes being taken?
Yes, absolutely. Once the death warrant is issued, the clock starts ticking. There's 30 days for the Department of Correction to execute the individual named in the death warrant. And so whoever the offender is, the defense attorneys will start filing appeals. There's an issue in the federal courts outside of the commission hearing that's coming. So yeah, I think this is pretty standard. I think attorneys are trying to do everything they can to keep Mr. Creech alive.
Okay. Don, I want to shift gears now and talk about the city of Boise having a new officer of police accountability. And I think it's pretty fair to say that this comes after a tumultuous time at the department. So can you start by kind of giving us some background for maybe folks who have not been following this office very closely?
Hi, Gemma. Sure. Boy, that is a hard question to answer. I almost just want to read my story out loud.
I know, right?
A lot has happened at the Boise Police Department over the last couple of years. The Office of Police Accountability is meant as a sort of check and balance on what happens within the police department. Of course, there's internal affairs, which is under the purview of the chief and within the organization of Boise Police. But this idea of an outside party dates back to the 1990s in Boise, when there was a string of shootings of citizens, and also a shooting that left former officer Mark Stahl dead. And so the community kind of came together along with city leadership under the time under former Mayor Brent Coles and said, let's do something. And they launched the Office of the Police Ombudsman. Over the last decade, that office has changed quite a bit. Under former Mayor Dave Beter, the office was cut to part-time, and the form changed quite a bit. When Boise Mayor Laura McClain came into office, she and the city council decided that they were going to bump this office back up to full-time. And they hired an individual by the name of Jesus Jara. And suffice to say, Mr. Jara wasn't in the office long. He got into some challenges with the city last fall over a whole nexus of issues. And one of which was a set of officer complaints into former Boise Police Chief Ryan Lee. There was an incident now two years ago this fall, where Chief Lee demonstrated a hold on a Boise Police officer, and that officer said that they were severely injured. That prompted a outside investigation from the Idaho State Police and some other actions. There's this whole interesting overlapping nexus of events that have led to just a rash of lawsuits. Jesus Jara is suing the city for what he says are violations of Idaho's Whistleblower Act and wrongful termination. Ryan Lee is suing the sergeant who alleges that he was injured by Lee for libel. That officer, Sergeant Kirk Rush, is suing the city over that incident with Ryan Lee. Former officer Tom Fleming is suing the city over what he said were fears of retaliation. The city, as people know, undertook an investigation into the racist writings of former officer Matt Bringelson. The city launched that investigation, got into it, and then decided to stop over cost concerns. There are also a number of lawsuits from citizens over interactions with police. And I think it's worth noting that so far this year, Boise police officers have been involved in 6 different encounters that ended in shootings, and 4 people have been left dead from those interactions. That's actually more people who have been killed in the city of Boise by murder this year.
Wow.
And so you say all that, there's a lot there, right? And
yeah, yeah.
I think it's also important to know that crime in the city has trended down. Idaho State Police statistics for the city of Boise show that crime has dropped each of the past 5 years. So there's a lot going on. After Jesus Jara was terminated last year by the city, they decided to launch a search for a new director. And that took about 6 or 7 months. And they landed on Nicole McKay. Nicole was the former chief deputy under Attorney General Lawrence Wasdin. Until January of this year, she left the office when Raul Labrador came into office. And we had about a 30-minute conversation. I didn't get to cover everything that I wanted, but she talked a little bit about how she sees her role in the office and what she wants to do. She admits she doesn't have a background in policing, but obviously a fairly high-powered attorney and background in Idaho law, working in the Attorney General's office dating back to the early 90s, and a longtime citizen of Boise. While she couldn't really comment on that big tangle of cases that I just talked to you about, she did talk generally about a number of issues, including what she called as seeing a lot of incidents that deal with professionalism and interactions with police that maybe the people, the members of the public thought weren't as professional as they could be. And so she sees some room for improvement. She talks about the challenges that officers face in the job. Policing is, I think it's fair to say, complicated in our country historically and certainly right now. And so she talks about some of the challenges there. She talks about the challenges that citizens face in interactions with police, especially when it comes to, you know, potential issues with mental health, what is causing people to potentially pull weapons in presence of officers, which obviously often ends in complicated, problematic situations. She also talks about transparency. Earlier this year, outside of the area where the Boise, downtown Boise bars are located, police got in an altercation with the subject. And while we don't know a lot of detail, it is our understanding that the person was shot and killed and shot in the back. And but we don't know a lot. The media doesn't know a lot. And very little detail has been released. And so I talked to her a little bit about what type of information to be released is appropriate. She notes that in some states they've moved to requiring disclosure of all the particulars of an instance within 48 hours. And she doesn't know if that's the right balance here in Idaho, because there's other factors. So there's a lot to this. There's a lot to the policing angle in Boise. That's not to even get into the overlay of politics right now. Obviously, we're in the middle of a mayoral campaign with an incumbent mayor who's been in office for most of those incidents I described earlier, who's running against a former police chief. And so she also worked for a conservative attorney general for a long time, and now she's working for a Democratic mayor. And so there's a lot to this. And you can actually, what we decided to do here is post the transcript of our interview. We're going to post the conversation that I had with her as a podcast early next week too. So if people like to listen to audio, obviously they're listening to Idaho Matters, so they probably do. You'll be able to hear that next week as well.
So Ruth, the Idaho Board of Land Commissioners got the final fire season update for our state earlier this week. Talk to us about kind of the main highlights, and one being how these fires are being started.
Yeah, the land board received its final fire season update, and it was relatively good for the year. We had 284 wildfires in 23, and all but 78 of them were human caused, which means very few of them were caused by things like lightning. Department of Lands Director Dustin Miller did talk a little bit about the fact that because Idaho is growing, there is more of this urban-rural interface. People are living in areas where they did not used to live. Something that I think is positive to note that the land board covered only about 2,500 acres burned this year, which is nearly half of what burned in 2022. And it's only a fraction of what burned in 2021, which was a huge fire season. It had more than 141,000 acres burn in Idaho. So, I mean, as far as the cause, yes, most are human caused. There are things like fireworks, backfiring cars, cigarettes, or campers being irresponsible when camping in the wilderness and starting fires. So it's yet another reminder to be cautious when you are outdoors. The price tag that comes with that for 2023 is so it's about $22 million. The state will have an obligation of about $17.3 million in expenses just for handling these wildfires.
So Murphy, I know that it does seem like it was a light fire year, as Ruth was just talking about. But talk to us about what else the numbers show, because I mean, you could argue that some fairly exceptional things did happen.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the feeling that I had about the numbers. I mean, I think every listener will recall the just horrific wildfire in Lahaina in Hawaii claimed around 100 lives and destroyed much of the historic community. And then, of course, there was also just the extraordinary fire season in Canada, which blanketed much of the East Coast in smoke for weeks on end. And it, I mean, it's really hard to overstate just how extreme that season was in Canada. I mean, well over 40 million acres burned. That is 2.5 times the previous standing record set in 1995, and 6 times the 10-year season average. That's according to a recent report by the CBC in Canada. So, I mean, just an absolutely off-the-chart season in our neighbor just to the north, which had impacts here in the United States. But then here in the U.S., I mean, we don't have the final season numbers yet, but as of today, some 2.5 million acres had burned, and that is just 41% of the 10-year average, year-to-date average for 2013 to 2022. And so the current year is far and away the lightest season in that 10-year period. Mm-hmm. And obviously things could still happen, you know, like Southern California famously can burn well into the fall. But there's the real possibility of this being the one of the slowest seasons, or if not the slowest season in a quarter century. And, you know, Idaho also had a relatively light season here locally, as Ruth was just mentioning, and our colleague Rachel Cohen recently reported.
I have to say, it's the first time that I can remember in years, Murphy, where we haven't had just smoke covering the valley in certain parts of the summer. But with that said, what could this then mean for upcoming fire seasons?
Yeah, so I mean, that really is kind of the key question here, at least one of them. So I spoke with Basil Nurzynski, and he's the lead meteorologist out of the Great Basin Coordination Center in Salt Lake City. So, you know, I guess, like, first off, kind of, you know, there are those folks kind of pointing to this this pretty slow year in the U.S. at least, you know, kind of saying that this is, you know, evidence undermining the idea that, you know, the climate change fueled increase in wildfires that many have suggested is on tap. You know, that you know, maybe this suggests that might not be the case. But responding to that idea specifically, he said, quote, you know, one season does not a trend make, which I think is worth having in our minds, and said that, you know, the long term trend of hotter, drier weather and increased fire, that's just undeniable. But, you know, with historic snowpacks last year, federal forecasters, as early as the late spring before the season really had even started, they were already predicting a below average or average season for much of the West. And then after that, El Nino set in. Some parts of the West saw above average monsoons, and then we had heavy rainfall. I believe it reached as far as us here in Idaho from the remnants of Hurricane Hillary. So basically, the much of the West never really got the kind of like several weeks long drying period that's really necessary to have a very active fire season. But at the same time, all of that moisture, of course, means a great year for the growth of grasses and other fine, flashy fuels that are often what carry fires. And New Brzezinski called a season like the one we just had basically a double-edged sword. So, you know, all that growth and the limited acres burned, that could really set us up for a much more active season next year if we do get a season of more typical dryness.
Mm-hmm. So, Will, let me bring you into the conversation because you recently reported on an environmental group that has been able to fend off a gold mine near Yellowstone.
Yeah, this was a pretty big win in the conservation world. There's always been interest in mining near Yellowstone, in particular gold. And although there's a lot of protected area with the park and areas around the park, there's some, I guess you could just call them enclaves of mining claims that exist around the park. And one mining company was looking to dig for gold there. And, you know, rather than take this fight to courts or do, you know, other methods, a conservation group in the Mountain West called the Greater Yellowstone Coalition negotiated with the mining company itself and decided, hey, if we raise enough money, can we just buy the claim off of you and then maybe donate it back to the federal government or do something else? So that's what they did. They raised $6.25 million and bought more than 1,300 acres of mineral claims and rights right just over the border into Montana from Wyoming, right near Yellowstone in what's called the Paradise Valley. This is just a beautiful area that has views across the park, even towards the Tetons. If you can imagine, it's just a spectacular place. And it was a pretty big win for conservation groups. And I should say, maybe potentially a blueprint for how to get conservation wins going forward. Congress is in gridlock, not just right now, obviously, with the House Speaker race, but kind of all the time. And so conservation groups, nonprofits, private companies are looking to take things into their own hands to conserve wild and scenic places and negotiating, fundraising. You know, there's a lot of money and monetary interest in conservation. And so they took advantage of that and the obviously great, I guess you could call it status that Yellowstone has. And yeah, they were able to make this purchase and we'll see if it works other places in the West.
Mm-hmm. So Carly, talk to us about what's going on over in Idaho Falls. This is in regards to a lawsuit about what, some school administrators using public funds inappropriately?
Yeah, so back in November 2022, the Idaho Falls School District had put a $250 million bond issue on the ballot that ultimately failed. And patrons had felt that they'd inappropriately used public monies to advocate for the bond. And school districts can only use taxpayer monies to inform about a bond. So the patrons reported them to the local sheriff, who passed it on to prosecutor Randy Neal. And he ultimately charged then Superintendent James Schenck and current district spokesperson Margaret Wimborne for the offense, which is a civil complaint, and fined them a combined $375. But instead of paying the fine, trustees decided to fight the charges in court. So that's led to some extended litigation at the taxpayers' expense on both sides of the issue. So last month, Superintendent Carla LaOrange, who's the new superintendent at Idaho Falls, she spoke with Ed News and critiqued the prosecutor's office for pursuing the charges. And then this week, Randy Neal answered her with a lengthy press release that basically defended his office and expressed his frustration with the case. He says he's not the villain in this story and isn't trying to go to war with the district, but felt obligated to pursue the charges after reviewing the evidence. So this matters because school leaders statewide are watching the case, and it will inform how they communicate with constituents about bonds and levies. Many districts depend on those extra funds from taxpayers to close gaps between state funding and what they say are needs. And that could be anything from new buildings to major maintenance and upgrades to teacher pay and classroom materials.
Okay. So when might we know more about this lawsuit?
So currently it's kind of held up in courts. The school district and trustees have asked a judge to reach a summative decision about it. And so we're seeing if the judge will do that or not. In the meantime, three major education organizations, including Idaho's Associations for Administrators, for School Board Trustees, and for District Communication Directors, came together this week to support Idaho Falls school leaders in an op-ed they wrote for Ed News. And they wrote that if the judge upholds Neal's finding, the organization, or they think that it could really silence districts as they seek taxpayer support, and that could basically inhibit their ability to function as they should. So for now, we're just kind of in a holding pattern, but it's definitely a case that has gotten statewide attention.
Mm-hmm, definitely. So Dawn, it's hard to believe, but we are about 2.5 weeks out from Election Day, and Boise Mayor Lauren McClain is trying to hold on to her position that she was voted into 4 years ago. However, she has got some competition with a former Boise Chief of Police, Mike Masterson. So talk to us about where this race is right now. And we should say, I believe there are two other candidates, but I mean, these two people are the two really main candidates in this race.
Hard to believe we're only 2.5 weeks out for you, perhaps. Seems like a lifetime away. Election season's fun. We do have four people running for the mayor of the city of Boise. Mike Masterson, the former police chief, who served until about 2015, and then again served as an interim chief at the tail end of Mayor Beter's time and the beginning of McClain's time in office. You have Libertarian congressional candidate Joe Evans, former Libertarian congressional candidate Joe Evans running. And then you have a fourth candidate who's running on a right to die platform. It's been an interesting race so far. It often is. Folks will remember 4 years ago for this office, we had seven candidates in the race, mm-hmm. and four of those either held or previously held elected office, including former Mayor Brent Coles and ACHD commissioner at the time, Rebecca Arnold. This time, McClain is the only one with any elected experience, but Mike Masterson has deep roots in the city, and he started to run earlier this year, and we are just neck deep in this campaign. We have two independent expenditures placing money in the election. And so those are political action committees or PACs. One mm-hmm. Is doing so on behalf of Mayor McClain. They call themselves Boise Fact Check. We'll get to that in here in just a second. And the other one is called the Building Industry Group of the Treasure Valley. And the two candidates are kind of sparring back and forth. There's been a series of debates. I believe there's one more left to go. And talking about all sorts of things, homelessness, the cost of housing, crime and public safety, and a whole number of things. Let's talk about those PACs for a minute. The Building Industry Group PAC, they call themselves Big TV. They have been running some ads with fairly negative messaging about McClain. In fact, the messaging was negative enough that Mike Masterson came out and disavowed one of the ads that had some, I think it's fair to say, negative messaging about members of the LGBTQ community in our area. The PAC is still running some pretty sharp ads that are running against McClain. And then there's the Boise Fact Check Group. This is an array of developers and Democratic politicians that have put this political action committee together. We did and I realize the irony here, but we did a fact check, a Boise Fact Check, and found that a lot of the things that they have posted have been either misleading or untrue. And furthermore, the language that Boise Fact Check uses, I talked to the founder of the fact-checking group, PolitiFact, a little bit about this kind of positioning. His name is Bill Adair, and he told me that type of language is typically associated with journalism, and noted that they are seeing this in some foreign countries where countries will use this fact-check label, but actually use it to kind of push their own disinformation. He said this is the first time he's seen this boldly in the U.S. where they're actually branding themselves as a fact check. They have been backed by more than $160,000 in traditional advertising spending from the conservation voters of Idaho. And so spending a lot of money into the race, as is the Big TV group. The candidates themselves, I think, are both kind of trying to stake out turf. a lot of their positions, frankly, are really similar. It's not, I would say, a race where there's two candidates on extremes. Mike Masterson is a formerly registered Republican. He is running as an independent in this race. He is backed by former city council president Marianne Jordan and former mayor Dave Beter. And he's just got some interesting dynamics here, I guess, is kind of what it boils down to. And yeah, if you want to ask me some more specific questions, I get into it instead of just freestyling here as well.
I'm glad for the update, because I think it's one of these things where, 4 years ago, I mean, we really saw everything shift, right? When Lauren McClain beat Dave Beter, who had been the city's longest serving mayor ever. Yep. And to now have, you know, some can argue another very strong candidate. I think it's a race to watch, Don.
Maybe. And look, yeah. it's hard to give a sense on these things.
I actually
talked to a prominent pollster in town, and I'll just tell people we considered doing a poll in the race. And the pollster said, I can't use the word he used, but I just said we would both look bad, basically, because these races are hard to poll. A few weeks ago, the Masterson campaign came out with a news release about a poll that they did that showed them losing handily by like 13 points. And the news release sort of made the point that, well, a lot of people still don't know a lot about Mike Masterson, and I think tried to say that if they close that gap, that he could win. But I was surprised that a campaign would come out and say, hey, we're losing by a lot. But when you take my first statement and say that the race is hard to pull, who knows? I will say, it's fun to be on the show and talk about things that are hard to put into stories, but you know, I judge all of our stories by performance, right? I look at page views they're doing, what the engagement looks like on social media. We don't run this business on how many page views stories get. That's kind of what makes Boise Dev, I think, different than a lot of more traditional outlets. But I do watch it. The stories aren't performing like they did 4 years ago. People are just not engaged. You don't have issues like a $200 million library, a stadium, a streetcar that goes in a circle downtown. You know, those issues aren't animating. Without that type of electoral engagement, I just don't know if it's a race to watch. And in fact, if you ask me, the biggest toss up of a race locally, it's probably the Eagle Mayor's race, because there's three candidates who are really similar. And not to get off on a tangent, but in some of the council districts. This race, I don't know. I think it's either going to break for McClain in a very, very significant way, or be really close. It's hard to say right now. Again, that polling isn't out there, but we're running a lot of stories, and I'm trying to get people engaged to care so they'll read the stories. they're not getting a lot of traffic. So
I appreciate your efforts to try to engage people to care about an election. So that's always a plus.
We'll keep chipping away.
Yeah, no kidding. So Carly, in your latest podcast episode, you interviewed Idaho's 2023 Teacher of the Year. Now, as of today, she is no longer a teacher, and she's also not living in Idaho. Tell us about this.
Yeah, that's right. So her name was Karen Lauritsen, and she left because she felt that in Idaho, she could no longer be the teacher she wanted to be. She was named Teacher of the Year for 2023. And after that, she said she was targeted for things like attending Pride events and supporting Black Lives Matter in her personal life. And she said she does proudly support those causes and at the same time understands what is and is not appropriate for a fourth grade classroom, which is where she taught. So anyway, she said after being what she described as smeared, her parents suddenly started distrusting her and opting students out of lessons in her class. And her local legislator wouldn't meet with her. Her principal wouldn't let her use materials like Scholastic News because she was worried parents might complain. So feeling a lack of support and trust, she took a position as an assistant professor at Millikan University, which is in Illinois. So she educates future K-12 teachers. And she said her situation isn't unique, and situations like hers are playing out across the country where Teachers of the Year are being targeted. And in fact, her story went viral after a Boston Globe reporter picked it up last summer.
Yeah. So folks, you should take a listen to this podcast. And with this interview, I think it's really interesting. With that said, Will, talk to us about how some school districts here in the West are looking into a 4-day school week.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a national trend that's happening. And actually, the rural West is kind of the leader in looking into 4-day school weeks. For this short story, what I did, I looked into a district that's considering it in Eastern Idaho. It's in Teton Valley. And just to give you a sense on the struggles that they have with staffing from teachers for a number of reasons, they turned over 46% of their staff last year. Almost half of their staff turned over in 1 year. Think about how much that is to have to restaff, and what an issue that is. And that it's not unique for schools, especially in rural areas, to struggle with staffing. And so the 4-day week is one of the ways that they're looking to be more competitive and I guess appeal to teachers. For those who aren't aware of what the school day week is, sorry to all the kids out there, it doesn't mean you go to school less, it just means longer school days. And then for teachers, it usually actually doesn't mean you get a 3-day weekend. What it means is that fifth day, that Friday or that Wednesday, Monday, is spent lesson planning, collaborating. It just like cuts down on the stress for teachers, and then of course does give them some time off. It should be noted, you know, while some school districts think it's a good idea, and I think that there's some data that shows that, yes, it has kept teachers on board and become an attractive thing, there are definitely some downsides to the 4-day school week. There's some data that shows that for some students, it might lower test scores. Also, for working parents, I mean, schools are a pretty critical part of childcare. There's school meal programs and things like that. So the 4-day school week could come back and hurt things like working families. And so I think as we see this trend continue, especially around the rural West, we're just going to continue to see the pros and cons of the 4-day school week, which is, it's really a huge change the more I think about it, considering for our entire lives, it's pretty much been 5-day weeks, and now it's changing. So we'll see how it comes out.
Yeah. And I have to say, for those working parents, we don't get that day off. So that is just another wrinkle in all of this. So Don, what is going on with Boise State having to deal with a payday loan business?
Yeah, what is going on? Sorry, I feel like I'm answering all of your questions snarkily today. I blame lack of sleep.
That's all right. I appreciate that. And a lack of sleep because you have a new baby?
I do. Yes, I do. So we started asking some questions earlier this week after some of our readers asked us questions, because they had noticed that a company called Dollar Loan Center had become the official short-term lender of Boise State. They started to hold grand openings this week for some of these locations, with Boise State students, cheerleaders in attendance, and Buster Bronco, who's also a student. Huh. And the school uses a third party called Bronco Sports Properties, it's part of Learfield, to manage the rights to all of its advertising for athletics. So the deal with it for Albertson Stadium, for instance, or when you go to a game and you see signage, or you watch the Bronco Sports show on Channel 7, those are all done via Bronco Sports Properties. They also handle the broadcasts of the game on KBOI Radio. And, you know, as any businesses, they're under pressure to generate some new sponsorships. And so they've done that this year. And they touted this deal with the Dollar Loan Center. The Dollar Loan Center is a payday loan place. There's nothing illegal about that in Idaho. It is in some states, but not in Idaho. And the Dollar Loan Center charges 199.9% APR on its loans.
Oh my!
And so the way that works, if you look at their address, is, say you go to this place and you get a $500 loan. You have to pay it back over 65 weeks, so just a little over a year. You have to make payments every other week of about $42, meaning that loan, that $500 loan, if you don't pay it back early, will cost you $1,357. Oh. You can get a loan up to $5,000, meaning if you sign up for that, same APR, same payment schedule, you're going to owe more than $13,000. Some people call this type of lending predatory. I'm not saying that just to be clear, but that is a word that a lot of folks use. So we started to reach out to Boise State. We had hoped to ask them some questions. A spokesperson was leaving town and filtered me up the chain a little bit. I didn't get to ask questions, but we did get a statement from Boise State. And I'm just gonna read that here. The statement said, an employee failed to conduct the due diligence expected by the university and failed to consult with critical decision makers when assessing this agreement. Boise State takes very seriously its responsibility to our community and to our students and their well-being. The university is committed to ensuring that the companies and organizations with which we associate act in ways that are consistent with our values. They said that the Office of General Counsel, the school's attorneys, are looking into the matter. So what that means, we don't really know right now. They've probably signed some sort of contract here. Dollar Loan Center in 2017 was kicked out of the state of South Dakota, the state from which its founder comes from. It happened after citizens passed an initiative that outlawed both payday lending. Dollar Loan Center closed, and then they came back with a new model. And that state's division of banking said, nope, we're revoking your license. You're gone. There have been some other kind of issues along the way here. But we're going to be keeping an eye to see where this goes, because the business is using the Boise State, and I should have said this higher, is using the Boise State trademarks really prominently in its basically everything. If you go by, there's a new store on Broadway, Broadway near Boise Avenue. If you drive by, the Boise State logo on the window, the kind of the Bronco head, is significantly larger than just the logo for the business itself. Their television advertising hangs on being the official short-term lender of Boise State. Their logo is on broncosports.com. Boise State has touted it in some of its social media. And so I think there's going to be additional questions here. We certainly have additional questions that weren't answered, but Boise State is definitely backing away from a deal it signed that can put people in a bind if they get behind on a short-term signature loan.
Oh, 100%. Don, I want to wrap up. We only have about a little bit less than 2 minutes, but tell us what in the world is going on with St. Luke's, because I'm sure we all now know that they have a new text messaging system, because I was in the middle of a live show getting text after text after text earlier this week.
Yes, they have an issue. 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 So St. Luke's got a new text messaging vendor. They sent out, some people got 30 and 40 of these messages telling them that they are going to have a new place to get their text messages for St. Luke's from. Even when they opted out, people would say stop, which you're probably familiar with texts.
I still got them. They still kept coming through.
Yeah, they would get a confirmation. Thank you. You've been unsubscribed. No more messages will be sent. 2 minutes later, another message. St. Luke's said that they're aware of it, that the messages are legitimate, if not repetitive. They were working on it, essentially. And that's really all we know. St. Luke's has had a lot of trouble, frankly, with this customer-facing IT. A few years ago, it sent thousands of patient letters to the wrong people. And it also was hit with a data breach that exposed patient personal information. So they've got some issues over there, I would say it's fair to say. I think the text messages have kind of calmed down for now, but I think a lot of people probably blocked the number.
I did after 30 of them. Hey, thank you all so much. A big thank you to our Friday Reporter Roundtable. We are out of time. Thank you to our senior producer, Samantha Wright, and our assistant producer, Hannah Gardosky. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll be back Monday. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me, and I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on the Black experience. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get podcasts.